religions have often been criticized because of their tendency to a non-aggressive attitude. While this does not necessarily reflect their policy, it certainly does reflect their teachings in many cases. Religions have always emphasized the importance of acceptances. In the older theological systems, the will of God was regarded as final authority. Man could not go against this. And although he might sometimes rebel inwardly against the conditions that arose in his life, he could only accept whatever heaven sent. The Chinese had their own adage bearing upon this, in which they expressed the concept that heaven bestows and man receives. What man receives, he must take. What heaven wills, he must do. Actually, there is a certain rather valuable psychological principle involved in this concept. We have to recognize that most rebellion is essentially meaningless. It is merely an emotional outburst, an intensity, an anger, a resentment, some form of opposition arising in man, causing him to have a very negative reaction to the things that occur around him. If the individual has been trained from early life to certain disciplines of acceptance, there is no doubt that his worldly affairs will go more pleasantly for him. In the first place, religion has a tendency to blunt rebellion at its very source. The person finds no advantage in attempting to resist the will of heaven, whatever this may demand. He has also been brought up in a code, and this code has imposed certain disciplines upon his own attitudes. If he is devout, he has been trained not to hate. If he is sincere, he has been indoctrinated with certain standards of honesty. If he considers himself an upright citizen in the face of heaven and earth, he maintains his honor, protecting it to the very best of his ability. Thus, he has a tendency to defend himself against temptation, even as the temptation itself arises. He does not wait until it has taken a firm hold upon him. I know I have talked to a great many very devout individuals. Some of them perhaps were a little narrow-minded, a little bigoted. But one quality was rather clearly indicated. What their credo taught, they obeyed. If their doctrine told them that they should not cheat, they did not cheat. Nor did they have a great struggle with themselves to decide where the advantage of dishonesty might lie. They did not allow a long pattern of negative factors to take hold of them, to gradually indoctrinate the individual with arrogance or sophistication or open antagonism. I know that in the old days, when life was not as pleasant, perhaps, as it is now, many individuals guided their entire span of earthly life by a code, by a simple belief. They held to this as firmly as they could. They made mistakes, that is obvious. But all in all, they did save themselves a tremendous amount of misery. I know in the community where I lived, One rather kindly, placid-faced old lady was more or less a tradition even while she was alive. Her face was without any of the marks of tension which we observe so often now. She was regarded as a good woman. Good because she had a simple code and a simple creed, and she lived it. Her code taught her to be charitable, so she shared her goods with others. Her code taught her to be humble, so she carefully avoided the pitfalls of pride. Her code told her to live simply, and she followed it to the letter. She refrained from many luxuries that others enjoyed because her creed did not approve of luxuries. And when difficulties arose, she retired quietly into prayer, asking for strength and understanding and insight. And then whatever happened was the will of God. And she accepted it, with tears sometimes, but with a deep inner belief that what happened was right. Now, it is obvious that this type of defense mechanism, if you want to call it that, does have a tendency to simplify and direct living. In Eastern philosophy, in Buddhism, for example, Buddha himself made a strong point of the importance of watching the pressures that arise within us. At the first sign of some undesirable characteristic, we must transmute this. We must never allow small evils to grow up and become great evils. We must never allow a tendency to finally take such hold upon us that we can no longer control it. So in the Buddhist doctrine, the moment an attitude that was inconsistent with true value arose within the mind or emotions, it was the duty of the person to quietly but firmly reject this attitude. Build nothing upon it. Allow it no place in his life. And turn from it, even while the first pressures were forming within himself. By this constant vigilance, the person never permitted himself to become habit-ridden. He never allowed antagonisms or hatreds or jealousies to go on until they possessed him. So we have the question that the Buddhist of old asked, "Who am I?" And the old answer to this was, "I am simply the sum of my own pressures. I am the consequence of a dominant attitude that has taken hold of me. And this attitude has gradually become the administrator. It has come to use all subservient attitudes to attain its own purposes, so that actually the person is a psychic drive demanding the fulfillment of its own objectives. As this drive becomes more and more powerful and intense, the individual becomes increasingly ruthless. As the drive becomes an obsession, he is willing to sacrifice the good of others, the happiness of his family, and the well-being of his own nature, simply to fulfill this drive. Some objective has become an obsession. And under this obsession, the quietudes, the acceptances, are left behind, ignored. Until at last, the person becomes so set in his false opinions that even the most skillful therapist may have great difficulty in relieving him of the burden of attitudes which have gradually taken over all of his thinking and living. Against this, of course, must come the less strenuous, the less personal, the less egocentric qualities which we associate with acceptances. Let us look around us a little bit in life as we see it now to find out what is the difference between an acceptance and a negative attitude. To assume that everything is as we would like it to be would be a very negative attitude. To accept everything as it is, as fully right or complete or acceptable finally, might also be a rather unfortunate conclusion. But to accept the thing as we find it now, as the proper state in the unfoldment of something better, to recognize this transitoriness of the condition as it is, to realize that what we now face is the consequence of right destiny. It is what we have earned. We are in the condition we have earned for ourselves. We are faced by the problems we have not solved, and we are sustained by the wisdom that we have accumulated out of the past and out of previous lessons that have been learned. Consequently, acceptance begins by acknowledging that every challenge is a lesson, and every lesson is a challenge to insight. That the true solution lies in the skillful use of insight. That we must solve these issues and matters within our own natures before they have a time or condition or opportunity to pass out of our control. If, therefore, we find temper arising, we also know, if we are thoughtful persons, that we can control that temper. Another point to bear in mind is that everyone, unless he be feeble-minded, is perfectly aware of the basic principles of right and wrong. This dazed excuse that we do not know is at best applicable only to the most complicated situations. The individual who has been raised in any kind of an orderly atmosphere, who has any principles within himself, who has any faith in values whatsoever, and even though he be a materialist, has any consideration for the public good, will know that temper will gain nothing of value. The individual using temperament in an emergency is simply exhausting his own resources. Every explosion of disposition is an enervating thing. Now, modern psychologists take the ground that we need to get rid of these pressures. That therefore, when we feel like exploding, we had better explode. There is very little real common sense in this attitude. And to try to treat with psychotherapy the perpetual exploder is an almost useless task. Actually, we can liken the pressure of temperament to the pressure of steam in a boiler. Certainly, there is a safety valve on this boiler. And we can, under certain conditions, open this valve and let off steam. We then close the valve, go back to some other occupation, and a little later we must come back, open the valve again, and let off more steam. The reason being that all the time, steam is being generated by the fire under the boiler. If you want to prevent this steam pressure from rising beyond a reasonable degree, you've got to lower the fire under the boiler. You have nothing to gain by constantly letting off steam and then creating more. The idea that we will finally get rid of all the steam and settle down to be quiet people is more or less ridiculous. The only reason we do not realize how foolish this attitude is that somewhere along the individual drops dead letting off steam, so we never know what he might have done had he exhausted all of it. It exhausts him first. It is obvious then that the attitude of acceptances is reducing the pressure behind the personality. Therefore, the personality will not build up pressure. It will not build up this steam, which must be constantly released by some artificial procedure. If we do not build up tension, we will not need to take sedation to control tension. We will not find it necessary to block intensities by various bromides if we do not create the tension. All tensions have a destructive effect, finally, upon some part of our compound natures. They damage structure. They impair function. They establish the bases for physical and nervous and emotional ailments. They make us sick, slowly but surely. Now, some insist that this is true, but only to the degree where these tensions and pressures are, we will say, not justified. We always like to hold the attitude that we have the right to be righteously indignant. And there are certainly cases where an individual has a tremendous provocation for being angry. There is no doubt that when we have been bitterly imposed upon, deceived, or injured, where it is obvious that others have victimized us knowingly and intentionally, we look rather helplessly about and say, are we supposed to take this? Are we supposed to be happy, lovable creatures in the presence of very serious wrongs that have been done to us? Is it not perfectly justifiable for us to finally turn and injure the person who has injured us? It is only justice. He has had his day, and now it is our turn to have ours. He has hurt us without consideration. Why should we consider him? He has cheated us. Why should we not cheat him? And with situations as they are, why not cheat him before he has a chance to cheat us? Always assuming that in this particular kind of life that we know, the rule is to impose upon the other person first. Actually, nature recognizes no difference between righteous and unrighteous indignation, inasmuch as it recognizes no difference between processes or situations or trends which are essentially the same in principle and are only subject to different interpretations. Our blood pressure is not any improved because our indignation is righteous. The damage we do to ourselves is not less because we justify it. Whenever we permit our emotions or our attitudes to become destructive, we are hurting ourselves regardless of the motivations. This is undoubtedly one of the reasons why we find the strong emphasis in the New Testament on the problem of forgiving the adversary. If we do good to those who do good to us, what merit or credit have we? For so do the scribes and Pharisees. If we, therefore, are injured and turn about and injure the person who hurt us, we have only joined our natures with those of millions of other ignorant people who are not aware that their course of procedure is going to lead to further misery for themselves. In the law of causality, the evil that has been done by another returns to him. The evil that we do returns to us. And if we do an evil in a way of spiting him, this evil that we do is still our own. We have set in motion a cause of further suffering for ourselves, regardless of the provocation. The provocation does not change the reaction of the situation. Nature does not wish anyone to injure anything. And no amount of injury by one justifies injury by another. It is obvious that this is a very difficult policy to maintain. It seems that almost instinctively we rise against an injury. We believe subconsciously in the old idea of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And when someone hits us, we want to strike back. And because we have been hit, and because we have struck back, and this has been the policy of mankind since the beginning of history, this is the reason why we have nuclear fission today. Because there is no end to this process of avengement and revengement. And today we are hearing people talking of ills done 300 years ago that must be righted, of mistakes that were made 500 years ago that must be paid for, and wrong notions that have been carried since the dawn of society which must bring their harvest of immediate pain and suffering. So wherever we are, whatever the principle may be, the only possible answer to any injury that is done us is to take an attitude of some kind that causes no further injury to anything or to anyone. Otherwise, injuries will pyramid, and what may start as a small disagreement ends in a lifetime feud. And even this may not exhaust it, for feuds will go down in families from 3 to 5 generations because no one has had the courage or the wisdom to break the tragic chain of circumstances. This is contrary to human nature, we can say, that it is almost more than we can ask of a person to graciously and quietly accept injury. Yet this is the only way we can outwit the cycle of causality. This further brings to mind another very solid philosophic principle. When injured, instead of turning against the other person, turn into ourselves and ask the question, why? Instead of assuming that the injury is completely the responsibility of the person who perhaps became its principal catalyzing agent, let us see just how and why this injury came about. One of the most common causes of injury is some injustice of our own, which has awakened a negative reaction in someone else. The individual who by nature is just, who by consciousness is kind, and who by thought is intelligent, and who by emotion is constructive, such an individual is not nearly so likely to be injured. First, he does not open himself to injury. He is not thoughtless or careless, nor does he set up causes in himself which others will naturally resent. Nearly always, injuries arise from a mutual situation of some kind. In the defense of our own attitudes, we are disrespectful or inconsiderate of other people, and they turn on us. Perhaps one reason that we are proverbially injured is because we have lowered our defenses in the hope that we would injure someone else first. This takes us back to principles of Western boxing and Eastern judo. Whenever we are off balance. Whenever we are reaching out to impose upon someone else, we are vulnerable. This other person can, so to say, beat us to the punch. And this happens a great many times. If we are trying to make an unreasonable profit, we will stand to take an unreasonable loss. If we are selfish, indifferent to the rights of others, we open ourselves to their antagonisms. And wherever we get into trouble, wherever we are the victim of something, to what degree have we contributed to the delinquencies of the other persons? This can be a very sobering line of research and can frequently prove to us that either through carelessness or indifference or selfishness or egotism or simple blindness, we have laid the foundation for the trouble that has come to us. Thus, it is not usually true that a noble, wonderful, thoughtless person is bitterly used. It is nearly always true that we are contributing in varying degrees, all of us, to a pattern of discomforts, a pattern of misunderstandings. I know we have had a good many cases recently of interreligious marriages that have pointed out some of these problems. Young soldier stationed in a foreign country has come home with a foreign bride. His family is terribly upset. They have never stopped to consider that the fair thing to do would be to wait and see what kind of a person their son has married. But because this girl happened to come from the Balkans or from the Near East or the Far East, no other consideration prevailed. It was simply a matter of extraordinary prejudice. When the girl arrived, she may have been also under a great deal of tension. She had subconsciously, perhaps, some realization that she might not be accepted. Perhaps her husband has pointed out this danger to her. She comes not at her best, but inclined to be reticent and defensive. This is immediately misinterpreted by persons who wanted to misinterpret it. They are just as reticent as she is, but their reticence is a noble doubt. Hers an unreasonable one. So these persons come together with a built-in danger of further trouble. Everything that happens will be interpreted in the worst possible way, because the parents have only one basic motive. They want to break up the marriage. Now, these parents will be very indignant and very hurt if, for instance, the young wife turns on them someday and gives them a piece of her mind. To them, their motives are above question. Their ideals cannot be doubted. They are only trying to save their boy from a terrible catastrophe, according to their thinking. But in reality, as some cases have proven, they are leading their boy into the greatest tragedy of his life. So the parents would not allow for a moment that their indignation was unrighteous. They were very righteous. They knew best. They were right about everything. They were right, except they were never for one moment honest. They were right, except they condemned without hearing. They were right because underneath all of their thinking was a conspiracy which was not right, and which had a wrong motive, perhaps without realization that it was wrong, but nevertheless a very cruel and destructive one. When people with this kind of subjective patterning are hurt, they are very terribly upset about it. They just cannot think things through to realize their own part in the pattern. So wherever we find ourselves suddenly the victims of what appear to be evil intentions of other people, we must give a little question as to what our own motives actually were. Sometimes these motives are perfectly acceptable socially. They are the motives that our ancestors use. They are the motives that our associates are addicted to. But these motives may still be extremely wrong as far as universal principles may be concerned. The only real answer, for instance, to this problem of the foreign marriage that I referred to is another example which occurred in Texas, which I happened to be very close to and saw it work out. The young son came back with a foreign bride of a very foreign background. The family was a little dismayed. They had been forewarned. They didn't know exactly what to do about it. But they sat down and they made a simple decision. We're going to wait. We're going to come to no attitude until we find out what kind of a person our boy married. If he has married a fine person, we're going to accept her. And we're going to accept her without question. If she has the power to make him happy, we're for her. Well, again, the young lady appeared with reservations, but with a great deal of innate charm and grace and insight and maturity, and a few months was the most beloved member of the family. They had waited for the facts. The facts justified an acceptance rather than a rejection. But if they had made up their minds beforehand or trusted to their gossiping neighbors for a decision, it would have been a very bad situation. So many situations that seem to get pretty difficult must not be blamed upon the other person totally. We are all to blame unless we all use the deepest integrities that we possess. Now, if you had asked any of these gossiping neighbors what their motives were, they would have tried their best to justify themselves. All they wanted to do was be helpful. Really, they did not want to be helpful. They knew just as well as anyone else can know that gossiping isn't good. But against the fact that what they were doing was wrong, there was a certain satisfaction that they were exercising an influence, that they were forcing a situation, that they were throwing weight around in some way, that they were becoming important because they were helping to advance a negative conspiracy. These people, any one of them, under a polygraph, lie detector, would have admitted that they were wrong. But under ordinary analysis, they would not admit it. They knew, in principle, they were wrong. But in this particular case, their action was justified. So we have to begin to think through in nature that principles are either always true or they are not true at all. Principles that can be adapted to our moods have not much strength in them. Principles that can be twisted and turned according to denominational beliefs. Principles that apply to one race and not to another. Principles that apply to one level of society and not to another. These are not principles at all. They are merely prejudices and conceits and bigotries. For we live in a universe in which there are certain things that are right and certain things that are wrong. We find out what is right not by recourse to the words of the wise or to ancient scriptures. We find out what is right in terms of what hurts and what does not hurt. Wherever we get ourselves on the wrong side of a situation, we begin to suffer. And we continue to suffer until we correct ourselves. Now, this suffering is sometimes protracted. It does not immediately appear. Sometimes it extends as a nagging situation over a period of years. But the person who breaks the rule has to live with the punishment that is inevitable. So philosophy has developed around what we might call a doctrine of experience. That which has never worked probably never will. That which has hurt everyone else will hurt us. That which no one else has ever succeeded in doing well, as far as temperamental problems are concerned, will be difficult for us to do well. But we also realize that out of experience, man has created a code that was first unwritten and finally was recorded for the benefit of ages to come. This code is nothing but the record of the results of long living. The results of cause and effect recorded in the lives of living things. These laws are unchanging. Man must adapt to them. They will never compromise themselves for his sake. Today we are living in a civilization, so-called or alleged, which is a confirmed lawbreaker. A civilization which seems to exist primarily to try to disprove law. A civilization that makes the attitudes or whims of the individual utterly dominant. We are expected to believe that man can live as he pleases, regardless of the level of insight upon which he functions, and that no consequence will come to him that is adverse to his own desires. We cannot prove this. We talk about religious superstitions, that it is very difficult to prove the existence of the devil, that it is very difficult to localize the true place in the universe occupied by heaven, that it is also very hard to justify some of the abstractions of theology. Therefore, what we cannot prove, we have a right to reject. But on the side of experience, where things work out, our attitude is what we have proved we have a right to reject. We have proved for ages that war will never produce peace. Yet this proof is to be rejected. The individual that believes the good man may go to heaven is superstitious. But the individual who believes that he can win a war and gain security and power for himself and his descendants by autocracy or dictatorship, this individual has a right to affirm that he is realistic, although he cannot prove anywhere, any time in history, where his kind have not come to a bad end. So nature has bestowed upon us, as many Eastern philosophers particularly have pointed out, an absolute measuring rod. A measuring rod to determine the effects of conduct. And that we should be forever mindful of the evidence that accumulates. That this evidence cannot be gainsaid. It cannot be denied, contradicted, or disproven. It can only be hopefully ignored. Evidence tells us that if we want to be reasonable, if we want to think straight, if we want to plan intelligently, if we really have some desire for happiness, for security in life, for genuine friendship, for true and honest affection, if any of these are meaningful in any way, we must live in a manner that will make them possible. And if we do not live in this way, we will not have them. Nor can any amount of bribery or chicanery attain them for us. No amount of rejection intellectually of that which is true or the effort to build up and prove that which is not true will have any effect whatsoever upon facts. We live in a universe of facts. If we abide by them, they will give us the results that we are entitled to. There is just no way of changing this pattern. And the simplest thing is to change ourselves into harmony with it. We all know that hasty judgment is apt to be bad. We all know that carelessness increases industrial accidents. We also realize that persons who are over-fatigued and drive a car are apt to have accidents. Furthermore, that an individual who has taken too much alcohol and gone out and driven a car is apt to kill himself and other people. He may insist on his right to drink, but whether he is right or wrong in his determination, he is still a menace to himself and others. His own attitudes on the matter have no bearing upon the reality. The reality is how much alcohol is there in his system. And if it is there, it is there. And no amount of platitude can change it. Everywhere, these facts have to be taken into consideration. Most people who make wrong decisions do so because they lack inner integration. Man has to possess a certain intuitive power in order to make successful judgments. This does not mean that he has to have some kind of metaphysical abilities, but it simply means that he must be able to use his faculties as nature intended him to. That he must have these faculties trained to a reasonable degree of efficiency. And that in all emergencies, his wisest course is to make full use of all of the available resources of his mental, emotional, and physical natures. A crisis simply is a demand upon everything that we are to meet the emergency that we face. To meet an emergency with everything that is the best of ourselves, we have to meet it with an extraordinary quietude. We see nature stepping in and setting this pattern in motion. I have gone through a number of tragic circumstances with other people. And nearly always, as an emergency becomes more critical, the natural tendency of the normal person is to become quiet. Over small matters, we may become hysterical. But in the presence of a great circumstance in life, a great tragedy, a great mystery confronting us in life, almost always we become quiet. We become quiet because we instinctively have need of the most of our own nature that we can bring to bear upon this circumstance. We need clarity. We need depth. We need to use thought for solution, for comfort, for consolation, for inspiration, for acceptance. And nature tries to make this thought available to us. Nature also, under normal conditions, builds up a tremendous reserve of quietude for persons carrying a very heavy load. Very often we are able and sufficient to tremendous emergencies. It is after the emergency passes, or after the situation is terminated, that we may frequently come into a critical emotional condition. The sudden removal of responsibility, the sudden shift of the pattern, may release a great deal of hysteria or tension. But during the need, we were strong as nature intended us to be. If our insight had been as great as our strength, we would not have had the shock reactions afterwards. It just meant that we were using natural resources to get through the emergency. But when it was passed, we fell back again into our artificial attitudes, and these gave way and let us down. Acceptance, then, is actually not the individual who agrees with something he does not believe in, does not compromise in any way his own integrities. Acceptance is clear thinking and a quiet decision made within the self. We do not need to cooperate with anything that we believe to be wrong. On the other hand, in matters where our own judgment may be no better than anyone else's, there is no justification for a bitter outburst of resentment or antagonism. If the person refuses to be tempted into an unreasonable situation, he will not be forced to fight his way out of it. Acceptance, then, is evaluation. It is the proper weighing of situations. It is the effort to discover the true meaning and the real lesson which every incident has for us. It is the person becoming so deeply aware of the importance of principles involved that he is no longer aware of his own feelings primarily. He is only aware that he must sustain values, and that he sustains values with dignity and not with conflict. If we had strong people, we would have very much less of this outburst which we are suffering from today. Very largely, temperamentalism is a symbol of weakness. It is an individual who, falling into the water and not knowing how to swim, strikes out in every direction at once and sinks. Whereas if he was quiet, he would float, and might very well float up on the shore, simply carried by the tide itself. But if we thrash around in a situation, the chances are 10 to 1 we will drown. But we will not drown because of the sea, but because we did not know how to conduct ourselves in the emergency. Thus, in everything, the cool mind, the thoughtful mind, immediately taking hold of the situation, sees the probabilities and the most likely way out, and quietly and in an orderly manner proceeds to protect values by intelligent judgment, decision, and action. All of these principles are possible only, however, in their operation upon the person having his faculties at his disposal. If his faculties are already tied up in a tempest, they are not available to him. When he seeks inside himself and finds only prejudices and antagonisms, he is incapable of honest judgment. He has destroyed the right to solve his own problem. He must therefore continue to make the false solutions that have complicated similar problems from the beginning. It is so important, consequently, in a time such as this especially, that individuals try every day to lower pressures. Not to lower pressures only in the presence of a major emergency, but to lower pressures continuously, wherever they occur, wherever they arise, even the smallest one. Rationalize through it and eliminate it. If you do this for even a short time, the habit of controlling pressure will develop within yourself. This is a form of self-discipline. In the Zen monasteries in Japan, the masters make life utterly miserable for their disciples. Everything possible is done to force the disciples to get out. He is not wanted unless he refuses to go. Every object that he turns his attention to brings about some, at least minor, difficulty for himself. He asks a question, and no matter how serious the question, he is going to be ridiculed. If he makes a statement, his ears will be boxed. If it is found that he has a kind of a quiet pride and dignity in himself, he will be appointed to wash the dishes. Anything in him that represents self-will or self-purpose will be relentlessly assailed. Now, this is not done from any cruelty of motive. It is done to force the disciple to make a real evaluation of himself. It is done in order to break down all artificiality, all false pride, and to bring him, temporarily at least, under the complete autocratic domain of the abbot or head of the monastery. The abbot himself has no interest in trying to dominate this young man. He has no interest in trying to injure him. He knows as well as the young man does the sincerity which brought the disciple to the temple. But he knows something else, which the disciple does not know. And that is that unless the disciple is able to accept discipline of the most stern kind without the slightest emotional reaction, he will never get very far in his search for truth. Discipline is this first ability of the individual to obey his teacher. But this is only primary. This is the kindergarten grade. The real purpose of this discipline is that the individual shall come to be completely master of himself. That in this mastery there is no force involved. He is not going to browbeat himself. He is simply going to learn to say yes and no, and mean exactly what he says. He is going to lose the word maybe from his vocabulary. Also, he is going to say yes because he has given every possible impartial consideration to the problem. That he will never say yes or no until these simple words represent the fullest degree of insight which he possesses. There will never be a snap judgment. He will derive no judgment from the opinions of another. He will not find his answers by recourse to books. In Zen, there are no books. He will speak simply and directly, always from the very best of his own understanding and insight. And he will work unceasingly to increase this understanding and insight. And the more simple his life, the more simple his decisions, the clearer his judgment, and the stronger his willingness to do that which is true, with no consideration for his own advantage. As these processes develop in him, his insight strengthens, he becomes more capable of reality and less addicted to error. He has gradually brought himself into harmony with the law governing existence. And this law simply demands that conscious beings bind themselves by conscious effort to the plan to which they belong. Unconscious beings or subconscious beings are bound by instinct. Man must be bound by a conscious dedication and a conscious sacrifice of self-will in order that he may live in harmony with the universal will. Now, it might sound from all this that the end is a pretty dour one. Here an individual goes around psychologically muscle-bound for the rest of his life. He can only do the things that he believes to be right. He must question his every action and his every motive, And as one non-member of the sect pointed out, nearly everything that is right is unpleasant, and nearly everything that is pleasant is not right. Therefore, the end is misery. This is not true at all. This has actually no relationship, except to the degree of the young novice who gains a hearty fear of his master and his switch, and who is constantly in terror of some kind of reproof. It is only after a considerable length of time, perhaps, that the novice gradually gains the great admiration for his teacher. There is the story of the young man who reverently and sedately and with all the formalities approached the master on several different occasions to ask questions, to discuss matters of importance, and to try to convey the impression that he was very serious. Each time the master physically kicked him out and said, "Don't come around here, I don't even know you. Who are you?" And the young novice went out very dejected, built up his ego a little bit, tried to get his self-pride back, went back, tried it again, got kicked out again. This continued until one day something happened in the garden of the monastery. A very wild, strange, wonderful flower blossomed. None had ever seen it before. And the young novice, absolutely possessed by the tremendousness of this flower, dashed unannounced into the master's presence and said, "Master, come and see this wonderful thing." He was all excited. He forgot himself. He forgot the master. All he could think of was the beauty of this flower. And the master embraced him most tenderly and says, "At last, I have met you. I have met the real you. I have met the thing that was not always playing parts, always dressed up, always so demure, always so artificially humble. Forget all this. Simply be yourself. But let yourself be always true, always gracious, always beautiful. Let it have this tremendous thrill at the beauty of this glorious flower." Thus, in the whole concept, there is no real frustration involved. There is no tremendous struggle against temptation, because the temptation simply doesn't exist there. The person suddenly comes into a universe of tremendously attractive things. A universe that, as far as he is concerned, is free of pain. He is aware of the pain of others and is dedicated by his obligations to help others in every way possible. But he is no longer suffering himself from any action of his own. He has compassion for others, pity for others, and a great desire, if necessary, to give his life for them. But it is all a natural acceptance of the right and privilege to sacrifice.